of session number 56, recorded on February 25th, 2008. Take it away, Scott.
We're going to begin to dip our big toe into the tiny note chart. We did sessions 1 through 45, reading quotes from Bob's Vatican Communion book with Bob Dobbs, and covered four quadrants in there, LaRouche and McLuhan and Thompson and Croker. And then we, on session number 46, we began Bob Marshall's charts. Did he do that in conjunction with Nelson Thal, or did he do those by himself? Or
no, he did himself, you know, organizing what he'd learned from me, but Nelson typed up what Bob came up with and printed the actual newsletter called The Perfect Pitch.
Oh, that was printed in the Perfect Pitch.
Yes, that was put in the, there were three Perfect Pitches, April 22nd, 1985, July 22nd, 1985, and September 22nd, 86, and they're only about five Xeroxable pages, and the charts were in the 2nd and 3rd, July 22nd and September 22nd.
And subsequently, those charts became content for the Bob's Media Ecology albums.
In the second, they were put in the second album.
The bottom up and top down.
Yeah, that was in the booklet for the second album, Bob, which was called Bob's Media Ecology Squared.
So we did session 46 through 49 on those charts, and then
I'll just say that they were put in by Nelson, since I had nothing to do with the CDs. He had them from his Perfect Pitch days, and he put them in the booklet. Okay, what were your name?
Yeah, we spent 4 weeks on those. We did sessions 46, 7, 8, and 9. And then session 50, we moved into Bob's formula chart, and we spent 6 weeks on that. We did 50 through session 55, and then
half of this one.
Yeah, 56A.
And the charts, Bob Marshall charts, were known as the top bottom-up chart, and top was bottom-up identity and top-down power.
Yeah, for Western culture.
Yeah. Those two charts are what we start off with.
Right.
So now we're going to do the famous, notorious tiny note chart.
Right, the inscrutable.
Yeah, the one that everybody has seen if they've been interested and came across them. That's the one that gets more attention than the one we just did, the Dobbs formula chart.
Right. We're going to make the incomprehensible comprehensible and sensible.
Yeah. I mean, the Dobbs formula chart is, you would say, not as difficult to understand. Even if you didn't hear my explanation, it kind of has an order if you study it long enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the tiny note chart is the after image of the Android meme if you place it in the 90s. But it's actually a picture of the original Android meme from 1960 to 1990.
Yeah.
And if you look at the Dobbs formula chart, 1960 to 1990 is the homeopathic cliche probe level and the anthropomorphic physical level. It doesn't include the final flatline level. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So homeopathic cliche probes, 60 to 77, anthropomorphic physical, 77 to 92, according to the Dobbs formula chart, those two quadrants become the tiny note chart.
Oh, I thought the tiny note chart was represented the 90s.
It does, but remember, it's 60, says the bottom, 1960 to 1990, which is the homeopathic cliche probes, which is 60 to 77, and the anthropomorphic physical, which is 77 to 92. So those two phases cover the 60 to 90 period. That is lifted out and becomes this chart. But this chart was presented in 95, so it's after 1990. So it's the after image of the Android meme, but it's showing what the Android meme was in relation to the Dobbs formula chart, which is the holopathic cliche probes and the anthropomorphic physical. Because when you look at the tiny note chart, it says holopathic radio satellite, holopathic television satellite in the far left column under Rai, holopathic computer satellite, holopathic satellite squared, and then the anthropomorphic physical. So the first four levels is level 7 on the Dobbs formula chart, the holopathic cliche probe level from 60-77. And then the anthropomorphic physical is the fifth quadrant on the tiny note chart, and that's lifted from the eighth level on the Dobbs formula chart. Follow?
Yeah.
Yeah, just remember, it's telegraph is one under ALP. Telegraph is one, level one, movies level two, radio three, television four, computer and atom bomb five, satellite and laser beam six, laser beam holopathic cliche probes is seven, anthropomorphic physical is eight, flatline ME 2012 is nine. So levels 7 and 8 become the same period, 60 to 90, the tiny note chart.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say, re-listening to the last minute of side A, I meant, and kind of flubbed it, that the five parts of rhetoric are applied to Shakespeare's plays being done in five acts. That's why many plays were done in five acts, following the model, the dramatic model of the logos in action, the logos in speech, which is broken up into five parts of rhetoric, right? Just
mm-hmm.
wanted to clarify that little point I heard on the side A.
Right.
Now, back to
the
point.
When you refer to the logos, are you referring to something that is...
it's oral.
Not perceptual?
Yeah, it's the oral culture's sense of its ground, which would be hypnotized by the speech medium, which they would be sort of half unaware of.
Right.
If they were molded by speech and body language, they would not be totally aware of its dynamics. They never got a look at it, and we call the phonetic alphabet or the general phase of writing as the first look at oral culture or at the oral ground. That means the oral culture became figure, and the concept of that figure was the logos. But those deeply embedded in oral culture probably didn't call it, you know, way back there, didn't call it the logos or have a concept of that. They had a concept of animism, I guess.
Yeah, but I think Plato had an idea of the logos.
Well, no, he's the one who coined it. I mean, that's the period when it comes into play, that concept. He's a product of the phonetic alphabet, which is, as McLuhan said, turns the oral tradition, oral culture, into an art form.
Mm-hmm.
They start picking it apart because they got the medium to do it, the phonetic alphabet.
Right.
It becomes the figure. So they conceptualize what they are losing. It's like the idea in Western knowledge that we fell from a Garden of Eden of maybe pre-Tower of Babel linguistic harmony with nature.
Mm-hmm.
Umberto Eco wrote a book on that a few years ago. We are feeling cut off from the merged condition of oral culture once we're fragmented through writing, and especially the phonetic alphabet. So we start to, it's like Humpty Dumpty, the egg broke, because acoustic space is spherical. So the egg broke, and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again.
Mm-hmm.
And it never got put together again for, what was that, 1900 years, till 1900, during the telegraph. So almost 2,500 years from 500 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
And then the human technology evolution put Humpty together again through the electric implosion, returning to oral spherical culture as content And the form is tactile, which is anamorphic, unshapable, unvisualizable. It's more than putting the egg apart and bringing it back together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I said that this chart, tiny note chart, is kind of like a memory theater. That's implied in the fact that it's an after image, a memory of the Android meme, which was the ground from 1960 to 1990. So we're going to bring in a lot of constituents of the 1960 to 1990 phase, but if you read the line at the bottom of the chart, it says, waiting for organic bodies, the spinning clothing crystals have danced the hexadvertisement. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So this chart is an image or ad pointing to the ninth level of the Dobbs formula, the flatline level. I always say popularly that it's the view from Connie's angle, because she's in the hexadic, the realm of the cold fusion environment and medical therapy developments, all right, that have pretty incredible effects. So if one is in the hexadic, which is the flatline zone, 1990 to 2020, here it is in 1995, we're in the hexadic zone, the hexadic is hidden ground, and Connie's looking back at the Android meme, the replay of all the technologies up to 1960. She's looking back at that in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
From the position of the hexad. And it's an advertisement for the flatline hexadic point. And until we get the cold fusion environment, when we'll have organic bodies, and that actually refers to the fact that media gets smaller and smaller, indicated by the term holopathic. They get smaller and smaller so that what we are gets bigger than the media. But we don't totally know what we're made up of. So the hexadic does begin to operate in the mystery body as ground. The mystery body being something referring, a term referring to the fact we've come a long way and learned a lot of things that our bodies were made up of that we didn't know through history. Now we've got four parts, astral, chemical, or physical, and chip and TV. But we're moving past that into an actual realization of a frictionless society, which is something we never experienced. And that's, it's going to be a mystery in how we handle that.
Mm-hmm.
So that area is called the hexadic, that coming condition. And Connie and I are waiting for that condition. We call it waiting for organic bodies. Organic in a multidimensional sense, not just waiting for our chemical body to be retrieved as an organic function. We're waiting for the effect of the four bodies moving into the mystery zone. And it doesn't mean that the mystery can't be further elaborated and come to be known, but at this point, we don't know how society lives in a frictionless ground.
Wonder if it's ever been done before on some other world or planet or...
No.
Is there any record of it in the Akashic records from some other time? And
no, I'm sorry. Ever been done here before. Never done here before, but it could have been done anywhere else. Yeah. In that sense, we're just going through the predetermined motions.
So the chart has five vertical columns and then five or six horizontal rows, depending on whether or not you count the first top section as one of the rows.
Right.
I would say that we don't look at the section under, well, the elements in the very top as being, we don't count that as being one of the rows.
No. Let me say this.
I guess because, see, the first row, I guess, would probably begin heliopathic radio satellite, which is the monad.
It'd be Ra'i.
Ra'i. And then if you count down from there, you have five columns, and then the sixth one would be, like you say, Connie, which is actually not on the chart.
Okay, no. Ra'i goes to heliopathic radio satellite. Eloy, the vertical list underneath Eloy, goes to heliopathic television satellite. Two goes to heliopathic computer satellite. That's TU. Lofty goes to heliopathic satellite squared, and Bob goes to anthropomorphic physical.
Oh, okay.
The five match up. There's no six.
Okay.
The six is off the chart. It's the condition of looking back, because this is a memory theater. And so while we're waiting for the ninth phase, we're stuck in a limbo of replaying in software communication forms, like the internet, previous memes that led to us getting to this coming situation. We're seeing the after images of the memes as well as the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is spelled out in the essay, Up the Orphic Ante, so anybody who wants to know what we're going to talk about, you can get an introduction at the fivebody.com, go into the essay section and read Up the Orphic Ante. That's part one. Part two is silencing the virtually solar theater.
Mm-hmm.
So, we are looking, it's like McLuhan said in his Playboy interview, we're in a world that is dead, but the world coming is powerless to be born. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is actually a gap, he would say. And in the gap, there's room for metamorphosis. So there's all kinds of attempts at metamorphosis in this gap, either trying to retrieve the past, adapt to the image of the present, or adjust to a perceived image of the future that's coming. So at the very top of the chart, it says, a chain letter of phase shifts. And the chain letter is obviously pointing to the fact we're looking at the phonetic alphabet organized in a visual framework, visual order, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a chain letter of phase shifts. The phase shifts are the shifts between Rai, Eloy, Tu, Lofty, and Bob, and ultimately, though it's not presented that way in the chart, are in an anamorphic distorting interplay. And I call it the Grand Wazoo, referring to Frank Zappa's orchestra in 1972, is what they would call jazz rock fusion orchestra. He had it going while he was recovering from his leg injury and jaw injury. And I say it's the Grand Wazoo's, meaning there's a musical element here. Decad dance. The decad was a term coined by Barry Nevitt, McLuhan's associate. He has in his book, ABC of Prophecy, the monad, dyad, triad, tetrad. Don't know, he doesn't have the pentad. And then he proposes the interplay of them as a 10-factor decad dance, or decad. I say it's a decad dance, meaning this interval period looks quite decadent from any angle, depending on what your bias is, what meme you naturally operate in. So you're watching the other memes dance around you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this 10 factor, because there are five forces and they're presented in five aspects.
Mm-hmm.
So the Grand Wazoo's decad dance, or decadence. And then it says, cyclotron of holopathic cliche probes, which are each quadrant.
Right.
Each quadrant is a holopathic cliche probe or a meme. And they're cycling through this interplay, which, think of the global theater and the interplay of all the different media forms, right? But that's a shrinking situation, as we have explained many times. So the hologram gets tinier and tinier. And we have causes merging with effects. This is all the title. the chain letter of phase shifts. Zinochronous Bob's tiny note equals a Grand Wazoo's decade dance. And I haven't explained Zinochronous Bob's tiny note yet. Subtitle, Psychoton of Homeopathic Cliché Probes. And then a further subtitle, Causes in Quotes, Merging with Effects. Now, we had that under HCE, didn't we? Causes merging with effects.
Right.
So that these are not the ground. This chart is showing not the ground. The ground is the hexadic. It's showing the figure. So we call it secondary ground, which is the HCE zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we call it Zinochronous Bob's tiny note rather than Zinochronous Connie's tiny note. And the Zinochrony is the experience I have as the last male, so to speak, if you believe that we're moving from a patriarchal into something new. Rai may be seen as patriarchal, though not necessarily, but that recent patriarchal domination is represented by the Bob image. So Zinochronous Bob's tiny note. Now, what that means, remember we were talking last week about how can I have influenced the world if no one knows about me and I make a couple of fringe communications and fringe media. How are you being of any influence? Well, I declared that the tinier you are, the more influence you can have on the chaos butterfly principle. So the tiny note can refer to a visual note, but also a tiny musical or sound like a dog whistle or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little multi-sensory expression. That's what tiny note means. And it's highly perceivable, highly unperceivable, and in that sense, it's tactile, because you can't visualize or hear the tactile interplay, right? And we'll note later the use of the word tactile in the chart.
Mm-hmm.
So what else can I say here? The Zinochrony is the attempt to be detached from the synchronicity that the Android meme generates because of the rapid interplay of all its constituents before the implosion of cold fusion. So Bob is attempting not to identify with the synchronicity and can do it by holding up the shield. Remember the Greek myth of the Gorgon, where Perseus was able to slay the Gorgon, this multi-headed monster, I think it was, multi-headed or something, quite hard to deal with. No, it wasn't multi-headed. It was just horrible to look at. So he held up a mirror so that the monster's face was reflected in the mirror. That gave him a slight detachment from the horror imparted by the gaze if you looked at it directly. So with the mirror as his deflector, he was able to slay the Gorgon. So actually, Western culture uses the eye as an art form, as a mirror, to encounter whatever the perceived threat is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The mirror is visual. So this is my shield, me as Perseus, holding up to deflect the Gorgon of synchronicity that the Android meme generates. So I'm trying not to identify with the synchronicity, even though there's very powerful synchronicity, strange synchronicity, always overcoming me. I don't have to do anything in Hollywood. They keep making movies on me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Synchronicity keeps being mirrored or reflected or gazed at me, and I reflect it with the tools implied in this chart. It's my shield.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the interplay.
Well, if you didn't have a shield, what would happen if you became identified with the coincidence?
If I didn't have a shield?
Yeah.
Trouble for every human being, probably. Who knows? I just feel inclined to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I have the intuition that that's a healthy posture.
Mm-hmm.
I may be wrong, but I mean, I'm not afraid of synchronicity. I get it all the time. But I'm not making any significance out of it that would become a pattern that I would ask people to repeat. But the Android beam seems to want me to create significance out of the repeated pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And make a fool of myself imposing it on people.
Well, probably some people think you are making a fool of yourself all the time.
Yes, because they think I'm imposing on it just by talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's operating in the interval. Maybe it should be imposed on people because it's a key to knowledge of our time. Who knows? This is an aspect of the pre-cold fusion situation. We're into the mystery here a little bit. I don't mean mystery as a obfuscation. I mean, it's pretty hard to know exactly where we're at. So I'll take the strategy occasionally of not identifying with the synchronicity.
Right. So I have the idea that if you did identify with the synchronicity, you would lose your perfect pitch.
Yeah. I would become...
You'd become one of the effects.
That's right. I'd merge with the causes. And I'd become a pain in the ass. So that's why, you know, I'm perceived as a pain in the ass, but I know my intention is not that, so I can take it lightly, any criticism that's directed at me as a jerk. Or a girt gawk, as McLuhan says. I think it's a Scottish term, a girt gawk, a jerk who gives jerks a bad name. That's what I'm seeing this. But it's actually a satire on the communication process we have. If we have endless involving communications going on, which may create a real problem and prevent the implementation of cold fusion, then a detachment from the communication process would be at least a temporary anti-environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I communicate very strongly, but I'm including what Dave Worster used to call significance. He used to say the cosmic awareness taught not to put significance where significance is want to go, want to be, that's W-O-N-T, want to go, want to be, inclined to the human bias for some kind of security. That becomes a idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a modern meditation. Mm-hmm. If you think of meditation as a form of quietude, a way of getting poise.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be a poise based on the visual mirror or any other particular sensory mirror because we're inside a very tactile situation. I mean, collectively, for baby boomers, the approximation of what they were going through, the Android beam was going to put them through, they experienced on LSD. The poise disruption caused by that experience, which included paranoia, hysteria, schizophrenia, panic, and ecstasy. How do we come down from that, as Leary used to wonder? How do we get a sense of poise?
Mm-hmm.
An aristocratic, what did Zappa call it? Aristocratic cool. Which, you know, the whole emphasis on being cool is the yearning of the average consciousness for some kind of poise. And it's usually embedded in faddish trends that are appealing to snobbery, a sense of exclusivity or specialness. And it doesn't mean that you're detached, living in the ivory tower. You can be right down in the gutter hanging out with a tribe and be a snob, like the Hell's Angels.
Mm-hmm.
They have a form of tribal snobbery, or any group does. So our present situation tends toward group and clannish mingling, though people drop their clans rapidly, move to other clans, which become symbols or memes. And so that's what the chart is, the different major meme clans that are seducing people.
Mm-hmm. Would you characterize every element on this chart as being a homeopathic cliche probe?
Yeah. Every word.
Yeah.
Everything on there creates its own space. and can be powerful for a few seconds. They're all mini Rumpelstiltskins. So in that level, it's a hologram, right? Every card is as powerful as the macro.
But
it's more than...
You know, there's this level of scale implied in, say, you have a category in the homeopathic radio satellite. On that, if you go vertical or horizontal across the row, you have monad and you have the word God. And then if you go down, if I'm looking down at the bottom of the chart and I'm looking at something as tiny as the Ben is Dead magazine.
Yeah.
Now, there seems to be a difference in scale in my mind between Ben and is Dead magazine and God. But yet, you would categorize them both as being homeopathic cliche probes of equal significance in that respect?
The God in the first quadrant, the Rai quadrant, is a product of oral and literate culture. Remember, Nietzsche, God is dead. How could he say that? How is God is dead? Because the image of God was changing, and a new image for God was necessary. By the time we get to the 90s, media culture is a God for people. A God that they can swim in and have different content and keep juggling different content and have different preferences and subscribe to magazines and then unsubscribe. Media consumption becomes the only what I call mythic stage or stability point. Like God, the concept used to offer for a civilized culture. Before civilized culture, which is literate, they had a different relationship to an image of the super protector. They had a dancing involved participatory mode of expressing something bigger than themselves that they had to make a contract with.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, if you think of God as a huge thing and it's important in your life and you're hooked on the literate, civilized version of God, then you would think it's bigger than Ben is Dead. But part of this is to show that the real God of our time is the Android meme, the interplay of all these factors.
Hmm.
That's the most seductive situation we have. As McLuhan said, we have a literal simulation of the body of Christ today.
Hmm.
The Prince of the Air is a master of hardware and software who creates a spiritual, ethereal substance in the world. So the literate, civilized imaginings of what a city of God would be like has been realized in many levels in terms of ESPN communication we have today.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we must defeat the conditioned image of God.
Yeah.
And point out the new God and its simulator, some would call the Antichrist, or its numbed expression or mirror that we're stuck in.
I think for most people who have some sense of, you know, their spiritual body, refer to the astral body or their spiritual body, have some sense of, they think of God in terms of divine intelligence or nature's intelligence, or but people intuit that this isn't, we're not in the kingdom of heaven right now. This is some kind of place of a trial by fire or something, but there's got to be some other place that would satisfy the requirements for what people conceive of as or intuit as being heaven, or something that's promised to us as being a divine world or something. I think most people would say this is not it.
Unless you're a Buddhist, don't they say this is the realm of suffering, and suffering is almost part of heaven?
Well, all as suffering, yeah, as part of the equation, the way that the Buddhists think.
Yeah, most people
think. And I think that they think that then attachment is also an element of suffering. So if you, like you say earlier, if you're detached, if you can remain detached, free of attachments, then you don't identify with the suffering of the world. So then maybe you're not part of it, I don't know.
Yeah, but most people, that's what I say the astral body comes from. It's a yearning for something more than this. So even though the Buddha might say, get used to your suffering, still you can't deny that humans wouldn't want to be stuck right here. Or if they did feel stuck here, they got to get themselves into a strange frame of mind to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an existential deadness takes over. Because it seems those that don't stay embedded in an image of where we are and include other possibilities have a certain extra energy.
Mm-hmm.
That's been the tradition anyways in consciousness. So it actually helps you not to... You can replenish your energy, which may just be something coming from this dimension. And you only have one life, but you can replenish it if you're in any environment to it and practice the concept or imagine that it's not limited. Therefore, you can fool yourself into having endless energy and at least for your life here be inspired.
Mm-hmm.
It's a trick of the mind if there is no life after now. If there is, then you could say, well, you're tapping into other energies that are there for you if you ask for them. It wouldn't be as complicated. They're just there. But you have to feel that they are there, or that there's more than this.
Mm-hmm. I have a note on my chart here. I have a number of notes that I've made on this chart over time, and one of them is that there are 322 elements, is that correct?
Yep. If you count them, there's 322, which is a little joke, a reference to the Skull and Bones Society, which is built on number 322. And also, they are like the last gasp of human patriarchal control. So this is an afterimage of control. What Cosmic Awareness said is Rai, the first separateness that felt there was a problem in existence or in consciousness and created different planes to solve the problem that it had.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like the origin of the Gnostic split.
Yeah, yeah. Just because it's Gnostic doesn't mean it's completely wrong. Their description of the source may be right, but how do you relate that knowledge to the changing conditions? Especially in our time where conditions change constantly, relying on a concept of how things were created is probably not enough because it's just a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Back in slower days, in the literate society, concepts lasted longer.
So what do you need in addition to concepts in order to get yourself liberated here?
You need to perceive what is the weather you're living in. And since the chart is pointing to the fusion of first and second nature, we can look at technological environments as a kind of climate, like McLuhan called them, hot and cool, hot and cold. These are physiological processes that ensnare you or excite you that if you're not aware of the flip potentials in them, the unforeseen side effects, you might have a little more pain than you can handle. Like, don't they say the Buddha, knowing that we were suffering, had less suffering, could manage it because it understood it, and the Buddha was not afraid of it? So we got to be acquiring a poise in relation to what is upsetting us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Demanding our attention doesn't mean upsetting is irritating, but upsetting your poise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in terms of, oh, I don't know, I guess however many levels you want to break it up to is determines on what model you're using. But right now I'm thinking of three modalities of knowing. One which would be pure gnosis in the sense of Aristotle, in the sense of Plato, some knowledge which transcends all perception. And then there's concepts, which is more of a mental activity that goes on inside the personal reality of the individual, probably an effect of Gutenberg, and or the alphabet.
Concepts of knowing. That would be concepts of knowing or of gnosis. Concepts of gnosis, rather than gnosis.
Right. And then there's the world of perception. And it seems like we're tangled up in the world of perception and the world of concept. If we could get back into the pristine state of gnosis that transcends perception and concept, or locate that, or become centered in that place, then the world of concept, the world of perception becomes a dance, a lila, a maya, which we can operate in without, as you said, identifying with.
You sound like what I was saying earlier, the hankering for the Garden of Eden before we were separated.
Yeah.
So the idea of a split, yeah, you're operating on a feeling of incompleteness, which bothers you. Or maybe you aren't, but the third desire seems to be not satisfied with incompleteness.
Mm-hmm.
Wants a kind of utopic condition.
Yeah.
So you're saying those are three trends or three, or an evolutionary?
Well, I'm saying that there's perception and there's knowledge. I think those are separate, maybe possibly separate categories, and they may be intertwined. It seemed to me that in earlier discussions we thought of Plato as being more pure.
He was looking for purity.
Yeah, he was looking for some kind of a knowledge that was not even perceptual. But and then Aristotle becomes more involved with the world of the perceptual and the world of category.
Yeah,
categorization. Right. I think maybe, you know, when LaRouche talks about his hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, he's pointing towards something that transcends the world of perception altogether. And then when we look at the laws of media or Marshall's focus of attention, it's on how perception gives rise to the problem.
Yeah, when you say Plato's is pure, looking for purity, that's the archetype. And he'd come out of a world that McLuhan defined as acoustic space, which was dynamic, and moved into the beginnings of the effect of the phonetic alphabet, which created a continuous, connected, homogeneous, uniform space that was static. Thompson talks about this. He says Plato was in that phase known as the geometric era, right?
Mm-hmm.
Geometric symmetry. And that cracked when you get to the beginnings of the industrial age in the Renaissance and shortly after that. That cracked up the static literate, or at least manuscript, phonetic culture that Plato was at the beginning of. And when you talk about the third phase being dancing with the Maya, sounds like you've loosened up from the original primitive gnosis, passed through the conceptual ideas of knowledge and perception and gnosis, and moved into a dance, which is what we're being offered today, the decade dance. The decadence. because you've moved beyond the frame of visual space and kinetic space, which is the industrial, quote, dynamic, as Thompson would call it, era, you know, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, that, well, maybe not in the 1900s it starts to change, but the industrial era, 1700, 1800, that is an enhancement of movement and kinetic action, as opposed to the static eye-based phase from the time of Plato to the time of the printing press. So the tactile moves us out of that prison. So you would, just as McLuhan said, the Gnostics who believed in the inner light had to be a little upset that the printed book extended the light and was used by power, you know, through printed economic apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
Today, if you're glorifying the third level of the dance of Maya and one's ability to participate and swing with it, that would, you would have to look and say, this tactile dance is being mimed by secular power, what I call the android meme. And you'd have the same problem as the Gnostics in the print period.
Yeah. I think, I don't know if this is true of all Gnostics, but some Gnostic sects believe that the world of, that the world was not created by God, but was created by a demigod, and that kind of a demon.
Yeah.
And so they perceive this world to be, in a sense, demonic, and something that needed to be escaped from. And so a lot of them would practice severe austerity, severe purification, as a sort of method or strategy for attempting to break their identification with this realm so that they could escape it and get back to the world of light or the real creator's world.
Right. Now, there's two kinds of Gnosticism traditionally. The one that withdraws through personal moral endurance, the way you just described. The other is the one that plunges into the world and lives within the ricocheting mirror of sensation and celebrates it and annihilates oneself within that.
Mm-hmm.
There's two ways. You can withdraw or just plunge in deeper.
Right.
Those are the two Gnostic approaches. They're both assuming there's a world that has to be struggled with and against.
Yeah. One wants to, in a sense, deny their sense of desire, and the other one wants to, as a way of eradicating it, and the other one wants to satisfy it, satiate their sense of desire as a way of eradicating it.
In excess, yeah.
In excess.
And what's interesting, if we think of a position that's neither, that seems to be the ideal in the Gutenberg era and before, in the written phase, a sort of a detached engagement, but detached, not completely involved and hypnotized, is the ideal of moderation, which was a big ideal in Greek times, maybe Roman times. So that's a poise based on the I in between these two extremes. That would be the pragmatic mystic, you could say. But it's based on the visual mirror. How does one get poise? How does one avoid the extension of both those Gnostic extremes, the super detachment of the womb of entertainment, or the excessive involvement of a terrorist, say? Someone trying to take over or destabilize the status quo.
Right.
So what would be a position?
They're both desperate attempts to escape something that seems to be disagreeable.
Yeah, you could say that the modern form of escape in the sense you called it, traditionally it's called the vertical method, where you withdraw and purify yourself. People may be doing that through trying to get better and better software programs or high fidelity TV or better refined technology for their entertainment womb. It's one way of disappearing from the interaction with life and all its components. Then there's the paranoid or excited, hysterical, panicking involvement with social systems and attempting to destroy them or balance them. If those are two, and that would be the horizontal form, those two extremes, what would be poised in between, since it couldn't be based on the eye or the ear or even tactility? That is what this chart is attempting to show.
Right, or even a sense of personal identity. Would you take it that far?
Yeah, if identity is not something you are addicted to, but that is another way of saying you have a confidence or poise and an ability to resonate with whatever challenge comes along.
Mm-hmm.
Idealized in the kung fu and martial arts movies. I mean, that's a form of tactile and kinetic poise, that you can handle any attack, no matter how many members.
Mm-hmm.
How big the group, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what Neo does in The Matrix. He takes on hundreds of Agent Smiths and its replica, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's not doing it through argument, verbal argument, or oration, or reading a poem or painting a picture. He's doing it through karate kicks.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's almost proprioceptive, traveling through the inner rivers of the Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
At great speed.
Right.
That's an expression. That would be the involved method. That would be the horizontal method of the terrorist. And I think he moves out of that into a poise. But it can't. The poise he goes into would not be expressed accurately by a movie scenario, because that's just one medium, one sight, right? He ends up going off into the light at the end. You remember that?
I don't recall that scene.
Yeah, at the very end, Trinity dies, and then he sets off the TV image, that weird mosaic, against the Agent Smiths and gets them to annihilate each other, and then he goes out through the interval, transcends.
Yeah.
So it looks like the kinetic method led to some resolution.
Mm-hmm.
He basically disappeared. I don't think that is a comprehensive way to show how to effectively disappear.
Oh, what's lacking in that strategy?
Well, you're only looking at a movie version of the disappearance. You have to have every dynamic of disappearance presented to you, and that's what my chart is. It presents five memes of disappearance. That's why they're called holeopathic, and they're reflecting the way satellite, computer, TV, and radio disappeared in the Android meme into the seamless web.
Well, Neo had all five. He was a chemical body. He was playing the TV body off the chip body, and he had a sense of a spiritual body.
Right. And if one identified with the limited capacity of a movie to express my chart, then you'd be missing the message. The movie.
Yeah, you'd fall into the trap of, I can conceptualize how that works, and then you fall into the trap if I've conceptualized it, I've understood it, and now I'm living it.
Right. Now, he goes off into the light. That must have a big effect on kids, or people, innocent people who take the movie seriously, and they imagine themselves going into a light. It could be an echo of the light that one's rumored to go through when you die. But if the merger of first and second nature is creating a new situation, then the image of transcendence cannot go with such a limited unisensory mode of something you can see.
Yeah, didn't you say once that Marshall either thought that we put too much emphasis on the light, or that the light was actually a trap or something?
Yeah, he considered the light as a sacred symbol of the Gnostics, and he wasn't going to limit himself to the Gnostic tradition.
Mm.
He didn't. He saw the use of the Gnostic tradition for techniques of perception, but it wasn't the conclusion.
Mm.
Tactility was the closest concept to his conclusion.
Yeah, which can't even be. We can talk about tactility all the time, and we can get a sense of what it means by using some words, but you can't experience tactility. You can't feel it. It doesn't have. You can't hear it. You can't taste it.
Right, but isn't that something that's non-sensory? That could be what we were talking about 15 minutes ago.
Yeah.
An energy coming from a non-sensory perceived zone. Tactility could have been a metaphor for being superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
Or to tapping into suprahuman energies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a sense.
Right.
It's the interplay, and the interplay of the senses has been externalized into television and the increasingly android mimic condition we've been in for the last 20 years. So I think we're near the end of this side.
Yeah.
So I just want to say this is an introduction to, it was a good introduction to the opening issues that the chart is addressing.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's it then for this week.
Okay.
Okay.